Well, the first thing I think he would do would be to stand up and tell the truth. I mean, he had a great expression that was just tell the truth and watch them scatter.
So the further away the problem is, the easier it is to postpone action on it. And that's essentially what we're doing.
Be real. Because people in New Hampshire are really cool.
I'd say get in the game. This is a problem facing your generation. You have to have a voice in the decision.
Welcome to Facing the Future, brought to you by the Concord Coalition on WKXL, New Hampshire's talk radio station. Tune in each week as we dive into topics related to fiscal policy, like healthcare, taxes, national security, the national debt, and more. You will hear discussions with experts, elected officials, and candidates on how the nation's fiscal and economic challenges impact current and future generations, and we'll explore some of the solutions. I'm your host and New England Regional Director for the Concord Coalition, Chase Hageman. This week, we will continue in our reflection on 2018 during the holiday season. The next two segments will be a highlight reel or best of Facing the Future from 2018, featuring a couple experts that give us a forward-looking perspective on some of the nation's key policy issues and how we can best tackle them. As I mentioned last week, we've had many great guests on the show and fantastic in-depth conversations on key policy issues, and unfortunately, we don't have the time to play back all those great conversations. Our first segment will feature a playback of a show from May titled The Children Are Our Future that featured Mark Goldwine, the Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. In the segment to follow, you'll hear a program from October featuring Shai Akabas, the Director of Economic Policy for the Bipartisan Policy Center, titled Defend or Defund Our Future. Once again, thank you for taking time out of your busy schedule to tune into the show. Your interest in the future of our nation's fiscal policies and support for the program mean a great deal. Happy New Year. Keep facing the future. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I am your host, Chase Hageman. Joining the program today is Bob Bixby and Mark Goldwine. Bob, of course, is Concord's Executive Director. Mark is the Senior Vice President and Senior Policy Director for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, where he conducts research on a wide variety of topics related to fiscal policy and the federal budget. In 2010, he served as the Associate Director of the National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform. In 2011, he was a Senior Budget Analyst on the Joint Select Committee on Deficit Reduction. He also teaches economics at the University of California, D.C. and at Johns Hopkins University. And in 2011, Mark was featured in the Forbes 30 Under 30 list for law and policy. Welcome to Facing the Future, Mark and Bob.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to be back.
So, Mark, I wanted to start with a broader look here and get your take overall on the federal budget and its our national priorities. You know, what does our level of spending and the areas in which we spend, what's that indicate for us as a nation in terms of what our priorities are?
Well, I think if you look at current federal spending, you'd have to come up with two conclusions. One is that we are spending far more than we are bringing in tax revenue. And the second is that we are spending far more on the elderly than on anyone else, particularly on children. And you add those two conclusions together, that we're spending very little and investing on our children, and we're borrowing, which means that we're burdening our children with substantially more debt. You get a budget that's very generationally focused toward those that are older and towards the past at the expense of younger and future generations.
And Mark, you mentioned investing in children. In fact, you and CRFB are working on a series called Budgeting for the Next Generation, and it concerns children and the federal budget and their future. What prompted that study for you and the organization? And can you give sort of a 30,000-foot summary or overview of it and your initial findings?
I think something really encouraging we've seen in recent American politics is a new level of activism. Among younger Americans, among children and teenagers who generally aren't very involved in the political process. But too few of them understand the degree to which they're really getting shortchanged through the budget. I mean, we have an unsustainable federal debt, which means that every dollar of new borrowing we do today is effectively a dollar that's going to have to be paid back in some form tomorrow. I mean, we are burdening our children with a huge debt. A child born today is going to face $45,000 of debt off the bat.
Wow.
And yet we're doing very little to invest in them, to invest in their productivity, in their nutrition, in their growth.
And so you mentioned a very specific number, $45,000 in debt that they're going to bear right off the bat. What are you basing that number off of?
That's just their share of the current $15 trillion national debt. It's not as if we have to get the federal debt down to zero, so it's not as if they have to pay all that back. But every dollar of debt the federal government owes is a dollar that we've got to pay interest payments on, and that means that we're going to be spending more surfacing our past irresponsibility over time than our future investments.
And Mark, you mentioned, you know, that we're not investing as much as probably we should in children. What share of the federal budget is dedicated to programs right now that invests in future generations?
Right. So as you mentioned, we've launched this new series, Budgeting for the Next Generation. And in large part, we've been assisted by the great work that's been done at the Urban Institute through their KidShare project. And if you look at their data and others, you find that basically, however you cut it, we spend about one out of every $10 in the budget on children. Hmm. We spend about one out of every $10 in tax breaks on children. And even that includes money that we're effectively spending for parents on their kids. So that's not very much when you consider that Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid combine to make up more than half of the budget, and most of their money is going to the elderly.
Hmm. So you started to dive in there a little bit on the proportion of what we spend and where. Can you name some of the programs specifically that are used to invest in generations and future generations, and then maybe what some of the long-term trends are in relation to those programs?
All right. So what's interesting, what the KidShare folks and others have found, is that most of the spending that we do on children is actually programs that also go to adults. So, for example, the single biggest spending program towards children is the Medicaid program. And if you add Medicaid, Social Security, food stamps, a few of those other programs that go broadly, because children actually have a very high poverty rate relative to the population, they get a very high share of the benefit. But we also spend on a large number of programs that are dedicated solely or largely towards children. For example, education, both Title I that goes towards lower income and towards special needs and things like Head Start. Hmm. As another example, we have child nutrition programs, including school lunch subsidies, et cetera. As another example, we have temporary aid to needy families, which really is mainly a welfare benefit for parents of young children. So we do have a large number of programs that go to children. On the tax side, we also have the child tax credit. The problem is when you add all these up, they're not very much money relative to what we're spending on everything else. Hmm. And their future is much more uncertain in some sense than what we're spending on other types of programs.
And Mark, I've always viewed spending in the budget sort of going into two different camps. You've got primarily discretionary spending and mandatory spending. A lot of the programs you talked about that feed into supporting our elderly population, our retirees, like Medicare and Social Security, have a dedicated funding source and are part of mandatory spending. Where do some of these programs that invest in children, where do they fall in terms of what type of spending?
So this is really interesting. This is going to be a big focus of our Budgeting for the Next Generation project, which is the budget process really is skewed towards adults and the elderly. As you mentioned, Social Security and Medicare, they are mandatory in the sense that they will pay effectively as much money as needed to ensure their beneficiaries get their benefits. And they also have a dedicated funding source. Programs like education, K-12 education, are the other extreme. This money is appropriated every year on a discretionary basis. It is no dedicated funding source. And so whereas Social Security and Medicare are completely on autopilot, education has to be reauthorized every year over and over again. Hmm. Now, there's a lot of programs that are somewhere in between. For example, CHIP, the Children's Health Insurance Program, that's a mandatory program. But it has to be reauthorized on a regular basis, sometimes 5 years, sometimes more. And it has a cap dollar allotment. That's similar for other programs like food stamps as well.
And how does that compare to programs like Social Security and Medicare? Do they have a capped allotment?
Social Security and Medicare are effectively unlimited entitlements. Mm-hmm. I say effectively because they do have one limit. They have trust funds. But as long as their trust funds have money in them, they can spend as much as much as they need to basically provide the benefits they've promised. programs like CHIP and food stamps, programs like CHIP, I should say, and TANF are budgeted. There's a cap on how much they can spend. Programs like food stamps are unlimited entitlements like Social Security and Medicare in terms of how much they can spend annually, but they need to be reauthorized every few years. So the programs really are all over the place. But if you look at them holistically, what you see is that programs for children tend to be 1 year, 5 years, and tend to be more capped and tend to grow with inflation, sometimes a bit faster, sometimes a bit slower. Whereas programs for adults and the elderly especially tend to be more on the entitlement side. They tend to be uncapped and they tend to be permanent.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking with Mark Goldwine and Bob Bixby. It seems like if a lot of the funding for these programs is in the discretionary side of the budget, that it puts a lot of them at risk. And then we saw recent legislation with the president putting forth a rescissions package that focused a little bit on CHIP. Why might there be a reluctance in making reforms or changes in Social Security and Medicare versus, you know, almost keeping things like CHIP and other programs constantly on potentially the chopping block?
Well, I think we overstate a little if we pretend that programs for children are unpopular. And the truth is, there aren't very many spending cuts in government, either for the elderly or for the children. Difference is the starting point. The starting presumption for Social Security and Medicare is basically that they're going to grow at give or take 8% a year. So anytime that we have a proposal that grows them at 7% a year, that's considered a cut. On the other hand, the starting presumption for a lot of these education programs is effectively zero nominal growth. So if we give them just an inflation adjustment year by year, that's considered an increase. Right. If you think about an inequity, when giving children 2% at inflation is considered an increase, but giving the elderly 7% is considered a cut, that's a large reason we end up in the situation we're in, where the elderly programs continue to grow rapidly as a share of the budget, whereas children programs really peaked in 2010 and have been declining ever since.
And I've been dominating the conversation, Bob. I apologize. I think it's a good time to shift over to you and see if you might have any questions for Mark at this point.
No, that's fine, Chase. You're on a roll. Mark, we've been talking mostly on the spending side. I want to bring in the revenue side a little bit here. Last year, of course, the big legislative action was a major tax bill, which is projected to increase the deficits over the next 10 years and the debt. What's the generational impact of that legislation?
Right. So we desperately needed tax reform. Let me start by saying that our corporate rate was the highest in the developed world. Our individual code was a mess. But the tax reform they did, was a huge tax cut. And the generational impact of that tax cut by itself is going to skew towards hurting children. But when we look at the specifics, the situation is even worse, because the biggest tax cuts really were on the corporate side. And while, again, we needed those lower corporate rates, big immediate corporate tax cuts mostly end up in the hands of shareholders. Guess who owns most of the money? People that are older, people that have time to save and accumulate assets. So, for example, the Tax Policy Center looked at this, and they looked at higher earners. Say, I'll give you the example of folks making between $200,000 and $500,000 a year. If you made in that range and you were an adult, you got about a 2% of income tax cut. If you made that around that age and you were above age 65, you got about a 3% of income tax cut. So the tax cuts themselves were skewed toward asset holders, which means they were really skewed more towards the elderly. On the other hand, when you cut taxes in a situation where debt is already growing unsustainably, you almost by definition have doomed future generations to either face a tax increase of at least an equal amount or a spending cut of at least an equal amount. And assuming that cut doesn't or increase doesn't happen in the next year or next 2 years, by definition, it's going to accrue more towards future and younger generations and less towards older generations. I can't imagine us coming back in 2 years and saying, well, the elderly got a big tax cut, so we're going to slash their Social Security. No, we're going to come back in a few years and we're going to say, well, the debt is out of control. So we need to make some changes. We need to do those adjustments gradually. And unfortunately, the reality is that means the children are going to face higher tax rates and get lower benefits relative to the folks that actually benefit from these tax cuts. There's a huge generational inequity already in the budget, and the tax cuts just exacerbated it.
One of the arguments for the tax cut, of course, was that it would stimulate economic growth and that would be good for the long term. And by definition, then people that support the tax cut would say, well, maybe there'll be a deficit hit in the short term. There'll be longer, a better growth in the long term. What's your analysis of that?
Well, the tax cuts are likely to stimulate economic growth in the near term and may even continue to boost the economy modestly over the medium term. But the issue is this. Lower tax rates are good for the economy, but higher debt is bad for the economy. And over debt just takes longer to phase in. And so basically every analysis has shown is that over time, the benefits of these tax cuts are going to wane, especially as pieces expire. But the cost of the higher debt is going to grow. So the next 2 years, yes, we're going to get an economic boost. The next 5 to 10 years, very likely the economy will be a little bit larger than it otherwise would have been. But if we start looking 15, 20, 30 years down the road, I think what we're going to find is that this higher debt is going to swamp the benefits of the lower tax rates.
It's not a case of the tax cuts paying for themselves.
For a tax cut to pay for itself, you would basically need $6 of growth for every $1 of tax cuts.
Ain't going to happen. Right?
We'd be lucky if we get 25 cents of growth for every dollar of tax cuts here.
Wow.
One of the consequences of higher debt that directly translates into the budget is the cost of interest payments on the debt. And one of the things that you noted in this paper on the children's budget is that I thought was very interesting is that the amount of interest that we pay on the debt is almost right now as much as everything that's spent on children's programs, and within a couple of years, a very short time, the amount of interest on the debt with all the higher deficits projected in debt and interest rates going up will easily surpass everything we spend on children probably by 2020 or so.
That's right. We're in only a few years, we'll be spending more servicing our past debt than we will investing in our future.
That really is worth.
It's pretty crazy.
Driving
if you think
home.
About it.
I mean, that it is. Talk about budgetary priorities.
I mean, would you run a business that way? Would you run a business where you're spending more money servicing your debt than you were investing in the future? I don't think so. And when you consider that this isn't a business, this is our kids and our grandkids that we're talking about. It's even more shameful. But interest is the fastest growing part of the budget. We expect it's going to pass children's spending in just a few years. It's going to pass Medicaid spending in the early 2020s, defense spending in the mid-2020s, all of non-defense discretionary in the late 2020s. It really is going to swamp everything else.
And Mark, that prompts a couple questions for me. One, it sounds like we are, in essence, crowding out investing in future generations from the rest of the budget with the growth of mandatory spending programs and interest on the debt. How do we start to reverse that trend or at least stabilize it so it doesn't continue?
The sad reality of our fiscal situation is, in my view, it's too late for us to reverse this trend. We've made too many commitments to the elderly, but we could slow it down at a pretty rapid pace. We could slow it down so we are, our debt is already owed. So we have to pay interest. We have to pay our debtors, and we're nowhere near a balanced budget. But we can slow this down in a few ways. First of all, we need to get Social Security and Medicare under control so that we're putting those resources towards the best healthcare and towards the Social Security beneficiaries that need it most, rather than just spending the increasing shares of the budget indefinitely wherever it should be. So that's number one. We need to get entitlement reform. Number two, we absolutely need more tax revenue. The tax bill that we just passed did some good things, but by and large, it was a step in the wrong direction. So tax reform round two needs to be about fixing tax reform round one. That means closing some of the loopholes it created, means cutting the tax breaks we were unwilling to cut. And if that's not enough, it means raising some of the tax rates back up or coming with another revenue source. And number three, we need to fix the budget process so children are less deprioritized, less than the elderly. I'm not so naive to think that we can flip this and turn mandatory programs into annual appropriations and make education permanent entitlement. But we need to even the playing field to some degree. And we could do that by more multi-year budgeting when it comes to investment in children and more multi-year budgeting when it comes to entitlements in the elderly. For children, that would be a longer time horizon. But for Social Security and Medicare, that would be a shorter time horizon. That would mean actually reviewing these programs every few years rather than just waiting for some kind of trust fund crisis.
And Mark, unfortunately, we're running out of time. I wish we had another half hour to an hour to continue talking about all these incredibly important issues. But if you were to make a plea to Congress on why it's important to invest in future generations as sort of a prompt to engage in some of these reforms, what would you say?
If you ran for Congress just to figure out what to do with the next election, you're not going to be there for long. People are elected to figure out, to solve our long-term problems, to figure out how to fix the next generation. And right now, we're in danger of leaving the next generation a worse world than the one that we inherited. And the budget process skews us away from investing in our children, while our budget decisions are leaving our children with a huge burden of debt. That's exactly backwards.
And you know what I'd tell them, Chase?
What, Bob?
I'd tell them, listen to Mark.
Maybe we all should listen to Mark. This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Mark Goldwine, and Bob Bixby discuss how the federal budget impacts future generations. We'll be back after these short messages. Welcome back to Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman, and I'm joined on the show by Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and Bipartisan Policy Center's Director of Economic Policy, Shai Akabas. Shai has conducted research on a variety of economic policy issues, including the federal budget, retirement security, and the financing of higher education. He joined BPC in 2010 and staffed the Domenici-Rivlin Debt Reduction Task Force. He also assisted Federal Reserve Chairman Powell in his work on the federal debt limit. And he steered BPC's Commission on Retirement Security and Personal Savings. Shai received his bachelor's in economics and history from Cornell and a master's in applied economics from Georgetown. Of course, you all know Bob. He's a regular contributor on the show and fiscal policy expert. Thank you both for joining Facing the Future today.
Thanks for having me. It's great to be here with Bob, who was one of the first people I met when I came to D.C.
I wanted to talk about a couple BPC initiatives with you today, Shai. One of them I felt was pretty in keeping with what the purpose of Facing the Future is, and that was Funding Our Future, which is a campaign for America's retirement security that BPC is working on. I wondered if you could maybe give a quick description of what prompted that initiative and what it's trying to achieve.
Yeah, absolutely. So most people recognize the fact that we have a major retirement security challenge in America today. People are living longer, and it's getting more and more difficult to save for retirement because wages have not been keeping up with costs for various economic necessities like healthcare or education. And with increasing life expectancies, there are more and more years in retirement that people have to fund. So, for example, I personally have several grandparents who are living into their early 90s, and that means when people live to that age, there could be 30 years that they have to figure out how to pay for in retirement if people are claiming Social Security and retiring at age 62, which is the earliest age that they can claim, which in and of itself is often a problem because they have lower Social Security benefits when they do that. But when people do that, they can have 30 years that they have to fund, and saving up enough to supplement their Social Security is really a challenge. On top of that, we have the financial challenges facing Social Security itself. It has been the pillar of retirement security for decades, ever since it was put into place by President FDR. But right now, it's facing serious financial difficulties with the trust fund that it depends on scheduled to be depleted in 2034, just about 15 years from now. And when that happens, everybody who is receiving benefits from the program will get a 23% cut in those monthly benefits. So in addition to the fact that we have this underlying challenge of people accumulating enough savings for retirement, the program that so many Americans rely on, it's something like 60 million Americans rely on for retirement security, is facing these serious challenges.
And before we dive much deeper into that, Shai, are you looking at promoting reform activity? Are you looking at getting citizens engaged and involved and educated? What are the ultimate goals here on Funding Our Future?
A little bit of both. We have so many public policy issues that are taking up the bandwidth on cable news right now, and trying to get attention to an issue like retirement security that is so important for the country moving forward is really difficult. So What we are doing with this Funding Our Future campaign that we started, just kicked off over the summer, is bringing together a coalition of partner organizations. Concord Coalition is among them. We have about 30 plus partners already signed on in just the first several months of the initiative. And we are trying to engage the public to tell their policymakers that this is an important issue that needs to be addressed, both the Social Security side of it and the personal savings side. We have three primary pillars for the campaign, which are to make savings easier at all ages, make saving easier at all ages, help people transform their nest eggs into a lifetime of income, how they make that last in their retirement, and saving Social Security, the third. All of the organizations that we brought together think that those are three important issues that we need to address. Many of them have different solutions that they would propose on their own to how we address them. But what we can all unite around is that we need to find solutions to these challenges and get policymakers to address them sooner rather than later, before the next generation gets into retirement with insufficient savings and with a Social Security program that is on the brink of a financial disaster.
And Shai, you mentioned those three key pillars, and they're very broad sweeping. What are some of the activities you've already started to engage in? Are you looking to have a final report, you know, at some point down the road as a result of this initiative?
The initiative itself isn't developing specific solutions. We are highlighting a bunch of the solutions are out there to show the public that we don't just need to throw up our hands when we're talking about these challenges. We need to look at the solutions and figure out which ones make sense and then enact them. We at BPC, separate and apart from the campaign, had a commission, as you mentioned, on retirement security and personal savings. It was led by former Senator Kent Conrad and Jim Lockhart, who was a senior official in the Bush administration. And they led a group that came together around a series of solutions for Social Security and the other elements of savings and retirement security. We continue to advocate for those as the Bipartisan Policy Center. The campaign itself, though, is going to be more about educating the public about the challenges that we've discussed and the solution set that's available. We've already started doing this and engaging members of Congress in that discussion. So we had a kickoff over the summer in Washington, D.C., where we had Senator Todd Young give some of his thoughts on retirement security and Social Security. We also had a large public event up on Capitol Hill where Hill staffers, mostly younger Hill staffers, came to find out not only about the public policy solutions to the retirement security challenge, but also about what they should be thinking about for their own retirement security, because it is really a complex subject for people in their own personal lives, in terms of how they both make ends meet on a day-to-day basis, save for other priorities, pay off their debts, student loan, credit card, mortgages, and also manage to accumulate enough savings for later in life when they're no longer earning a sustained income. So this type of educational effort and engagement effort is what we plan to continue with all of our partners in the months ahead.
Before I kick this over to Bob, because I'm sure he's got burning questions as well, and I want to dig deeper, but I had sort of this higher level question. I know you're not pushing for specific reforms with this initiative, but as it pertains to retirement security and the current divided Congress, do you see we're at a point now or in the near future where we can achieve some kind of bipartisan, realistic reforms on some of these challenges?
So it's interesting you ask that right now, because there is, in fact, legislation moving through Congress, if you can believe it, on retirement security. It's not the top of the headlines, but there are serious proposals that are bipartisan that would address some of the challenges, particularly on the personal savings and 401k side of the problem. And these aren't massive overhauls of the system that we have today, but they are important adjustments to the system that would make it easier for people to save, make it easier for employers to offer their employees good savings plans, because we know that savings plans through the workplace, 401k type plans, are where people accumulate most of their retirement assets. And if this legislation were to pass, which could happen either later this year or next year, if there isn't time at the end of this year, it could make move the ball forward in a significant way. Now, it does not address the biggest elephant in the room, which is Social Security, or the fundamental challenges that many, many people are running out of money in retirement with no recourse. But it will help pave the road for future generations to be more prepared. So it's the start of a solution, not the end of working on this. But I'm encouraged by the fact that our policymakers are at least under the headlines paying some attention to this issue and starting to get the ball rolling.
This is Facing the Future. I'm talking to Concord's Executive Director, Bob Bixby, and Bipartisan Policy Center's Director of Economic Policy, Shia Kabbas. And Bob, I've been dominating most of this conversation, so it's certainly a good time, I think, for you to jump in here with a question.
Well, that's as per usual, Chase. That's
par
that's
for the fine. Course on Facing the Future.
Par for the course. I really like the idea of this as a retirement security issue because there are so many aspects of it. And too often, I think the debate in Washington or among policy experts focuses just on Social Security, which you can do because it's got a dedicated revenue stream and benefit stream, and it's easier to sort of isolate it. But, I mean, what does it exist for? It exists for retirement security, and that encompasses more than just Social Security. You know, one of the things that I've been intrigued with is that people have incentives for savings that they don't take advantage of. What about the idea of having an automatic mandatory participation that you can opt out of? Is that a viable option?
Yeah. So, in fact, a lot of other countries have gone to that approach where there is a requirement to be automatically enrolled in something, in an account where you can accumulate savings. But then people have the opportunity to decide that's not their priority and not contribute to those accounts. We in the U.S. obviously have a voluntary system where people make the decision on their own. Certain employers do offer their employees accounts and do it with automatic enrollment, which means that the employee is automatically contributing to the account out of their own money unless they decide not to. And I think we're seeing more and more of that over time. To get to a point where everybody is required to be offering an account, that gets into trickier political territory, because the environment around requirements is obviously a delicate one.
My kidding.
An understatement. My sense, though, is that the first step is we need to make it much easier for employers to offer their employees these accounts. The burdens right now on particularly small businesses that have 10 employees, a zero-person HR shop, they don't even have there's such a small operation that they don't have a person who's dedicated to that. And then having them need to go through all the paperwork and all the research that is involved with figuring out what type of plan to offer their employees and what the different aspects of it should be is really far too challenging. So what we need to do from a public policy perspective is make that much, much simpler. And once that's done, then we can talk about having employers required to offer something to their employees. If the burden on the employer is really minimal, I think that overcomes a lot of the opposition that you see today, where small business owners are rightfully saying, we're focused on running our business. To have us divert our attention to running a retirement plan is not the right thing for us. And I think that's the needle that we need to thread over time. And there are several steps between here and there. Ultimately, I think that's the direction we might end up going.
So there are two choices. One is whether the employer wants to offer a retirement plan, which is really up to the employer. And then second, if they do, whether it should be a mandatory system or an opt-out. I don't know that this is true, but the people that could most use the savings incentives are the people that most need it. Whereas if you got people that would save anyway, who don't need the incentive, but their employers might be in a better position to provide it. So it is a difficult policy quandary, I would think, for employers.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at small businesses in particular, so under 50 employees, less than half of them offer a 401k type account to their employees. And those employees tend to be more often part-time employees, lower-income employees, minorities, all sort of populations that we would be concerned to not have that opportunity to accumulate savings for later in life. So public policy, I think, needs to focus on those populations.
One of the other things I always looked at just as a federal budget issue is that savings incentives provided through the federal budget. There's a concern that I've always had, I think, is do they really incentivize savings or do they just give money to people who are going to save anyway? So in other words, it becomes a government giveaway and it doesn't really achieve the objective, but it affects the government's bottom line. Have you looked at that sort of a trade-off?
Yeah, so there's a lot of discussion on both sides of that issue. What I do think there's consensus around, however, is that at the very top and at the bottom end, there are some problems with the current system. At the very top, we have people using these types of accounts as effectively tax shelters. So they get to shelter the money from government revenues, and the government's not collecting that money. And they get rewarded on an ongoing basis for that. So you have the example of Mitt Romney's Roth IRA, which means you pay taxes before on the money you put in. The money explodes because you put it into something that was not a stock type of account that was not yet public. It goes public, and the money's all of a sudden worth millions of dollars. So cutting off loopholes like that is really important at the top end, and limiting the amount that people can save in those accounts. When you have $5, $10 million, people don't need to accumulate more than that in a tax-favored account. At the other end, we have the issue that the current preferences don't really benefit people who are paying little or no federal income taxes, because the way that the preference works is by lowering your tax liability. If you owe little or no taxes, that's not much of a benefit. So we need to find new ways with something like a credit or a direct match from the government, where if you're very low income or modest income, you're earning, say, $20,000, $25,000 a year, and you put away $500 in your account, there should be a more direct incentive for you where the government will match that $500 in your retirement savings account. That would be a much more understandable way and a more effective way to help that part of the population that has the most difficulty saving for their later years.
And Shai, all of this sort of prompts the question for me. We're talking about how employees and employers might handle these systems and incentives differently. Have you noticed any difference generationally in terms of perspective on planning for retirement or perspective on retirement security programs like Social Security?
Definitely. And there are statistics out there. Nearly 30% of Americans between the ages of 30 and 39, so sort of the millennial or just in front of the millennial generation, have nothing accumulated in retirement savings. That's really disconcerting. Additionally, a lot of those same Americans, those younger generations, don't think that Social Security is going to pay them anything when they get to retirement. So there's a lack of confidence in the programs that are there today. Gallup did a recent poll that found 51% of working age Americans didn't think they were going to ever receive a penny from Social Security. It's hard to convince people that this is a real problem that needs to be tackled from a policy perspective when they're already saying that they don't believe the program is going to be there for them. And whether they actually believe this or not, it just shows a disillusionment with the entire system in terms of government and reliance on it. So I think we need to come up with policy solutions that are focused on those younger Americans, especially those that have large burdens of student debt, which are greater than prior generations coming out of their post-secondary education. And it's a complicated problem that's going to require several different types of solutions.
I think the Funding Our Future initiative, its importance is emphasized by what you just explained, which to me indicates sort of a fundamental lack of understanding of how the Social Security system even works. Even if millennials think the program won't exist when we go to retire, we're still going to be paying into it all of our lives to support current beneficiaries. I wanted to get to...
And we thank you for that.
Yeah, you're welcome. You're very welcome, Bob. But we're running... We've only got a couple minutes left, and I did want to touch on something that you, both Bob and Shai, served on together, or at least participated in together, and that was the Domenici Rivlin Debt Reduction Task Force. Shai, maybe give a quick 30,000-foot view of what that task force was meant to do, and then Bob, maybe you can talk a little bit about what it potentially achieved in terms of putting a map out there on how we can tackle some of these challenges.
Absolutely. I came to Washington back in 2010, and that was the height of the concern around the federal debt and deficits. It was right after the Great Recession, where a lot of spending programs had been put into place and tax breaks to help offset some of the worst effects of that economic downturn. And as a result, we had ballooned the federal debt. Policymakers were turning their attention to this issue, and there weren't a whole lot of solution sets out there. So the Bipartisan Policy Center set up a task force that was led by Alice Rivlin, who was President Clinton's budget director, and the late Senator Pete Domenici, who was the former chairman of the Senate Budget Committee. And the two of them gathered together a group of individuals that Bob was a distinguished member of, and they came up with a plan to address our debt and deficit challenges that we faced in the future. These are long-term problems. These are not problems that could be solved in a couple years, but they require solutions that are put in place over a period of time that can be phased in, especially for programs like Social Security and Medicare that have millions and millions of people that are receiving benefits today and we'll need to make sure that people anticipate changes that are coming to those programs. So they put out that comprehensive report in 2010. It was actually alongside and contributed to the Simpson-Bowles Commission, which people might remember President Obama put together, that was under the leadership of Alan Simpson, a former senator, and Erskine Bowles. And the two of them had an official commission that the government had set up. Our task force that Bob was on sort of fed into that commission, and the solution sets were fairly similar, which I think goes to show that there is a fair amount of bipartisan consensus on what we can do around these challenges. Unfortunately, and Bob can speak a little bit more to this, there have not been serious steps to tackle them today, and we're in an even worse position than we were 8 years ago, even though the headlines aren't necessarily reflecting that.
Yeah, I think that the dynamic was very interesting in that it was a thoroughly bipartisan commission, and people went into it with the idea that there would have to be compromises, that if you started taking your own priorities off the table, no agreement would ever be reached on something this large. And so there was that cooperation, which you really don't have that environment right now. But I think it does go to the fact that you can't solve the problem otherwise. And Shai mentioned that we came to very similar conclusions from Simpson-Bowles Commission, which is really interesting because there wasn't coordination between the two. Alice Rivlin was the only one who was a member of both. We both looked at the tax code and said that you could get new revenues by eliminating or scaling back so-called tax expenditures, simplifying the code, making it more economically efficient, and you could lower rates, but still bring in more revenue that way. And we obviously looked at the major entitlement programs, but we looked at them, I think, in a holistic way, as we were talking about before, particularly on healthcare. We looked at things that would not just address Medicare or Medicaid specifically, but that would try to make the delivery of healthcare more efficient, but more effective. There's a lot of waste, and I don't mean that in the trivial sense. Treatments that don't work, or over treatments, or the so-called fee for service system, where it incentivizes doctors and providers to provide more rather than to provide a more efficient and higher quality service. And we phased things in because at that point we were still coming out of a very deep recession. So we realized that a deficit reduction task force shouldn't come in all at once and say we have to start implementing austerity at this point, because that wasn't our purpose and that wasn't the point we were trying to get across. We were trying to get across that we needed to get a sustainable fiscal situation, not start chopping things or raising taxes suddenly. And I think we achieved that. But the moment didn't take politically. And now we have to wait for it to come around again. And when it does come around, you have to look at the way that we approach the task in a bipartisan way, and the way that you just kind of put everything on the table and realize you're going to have to make some difficult choices on mandatory spending and revenues.
This is Facing the Future. I'm your host, Chase Hageman. You've been listening to me, Bob Bixby, and Bipartisan Policy Center Director of Economic Policy, Shai Acabas. We were discussing what BPC is currently working on, the Funding Our Future initiative, as well as what Bob and Shai worked on together in the Domenici Rivlin Debt Reduction Task Force. I wish we could have spent a lot more time talking about those things, but I really appreciate you both being on the show today.
Thanks for having me, Chase.
Thanks, Chase.